You're listening to the UCB Longform Conversations podcast, in-depth conversations with performers and teachers from the best alternative comedy theater on the planet. This podcast is modeled on the improv form La Ronde, so the guest of our last episode becomes the host of this episode, and today's guest will become the host of our next episode. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center.
Warning. What you're about to hear is an extremely nerdy conversation about long-form improv comedy.
Welcome to the UCB Long-Form Conversations podcast from Los Angeles. I'm your host, Ronnie Adrian. I was the guest on the last episode, but today I'm the host. And my guest today is Dan Black, who improv fans might know from, just so many different things. I guess most of you know him as a New York improviser from such heralding as Monstro and Captcha and yeah. Dance Break and one of my personal favorites, Surfing. Haven't seen any of those teams, but for some reason, I just love the name Surfing.
I love it.
As a Herald team name. Also, people from Los Angeles might know him, and also New York, from Team Death by Ruru, and also the show that doesn't exist here anymore, but was here for a long time, Fucked Up Family. And also, you're on my team now, right? The Bus?
Yeah, I'm on The Bus.
Yeah, see? My team.
Correct.
So Dan's all over the UCB community.
Yes,
how you doing, Dan?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, man, just, you know, good.
Good?
Good, yeah, good. No complaints. Just maybe I'm nervous, you know, not really. Never.
Are you nervous? Are you actually nervous?
I mean, I don't necessarily think I'm nervous. I mean, I think it's just like, okay, well, hopefully I asked the right questions.
Oh, yeah.
Or just like, hopefully I asked the right questions to get you to do the talking that this podcast needs for you to do.
Especially because it's just like they threw a list of my Herald names.
Yeah, well, they didn't
in
actually.
Front of you.
I had to look for those.
Oh,
like,
really?
They didn't throw a list of me. Like, I had to actually go to the improv wiki and be like, oh, okay. And like, this is a guy.
I love that you said your favorite team that I was on was Surfing.
Yeah.
Because that was the team that I was on for, like, 1 month. I got put on that Herald team for maybe 2 months, and but then I was placed on Death by Ruru, so I didn't perform with them that much. So that's your favorite one of my Herald teams, the one that I left.
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess, well.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll start by asking, Dan, like, where are you originally from?
I'm from New York.
New York?
Yes,
so
I'm
you're
from Long Island, New York. Yeah, that's where I grew up. But improv-wise, you know, I lived in Manhattan for like 10 years.
Mm-hmm. All right. So before you moved out here, you were immersed in that community for a long time, right?
In New York?
Yeah.
I came to the theater in like 2007. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, 2006, I saw my first show, but then I took class January 2007, Will Hines 101 class.
And what made you, like, even go to the show and then also want to do improv?
My buddy, who is still active in the UCB New York Theater, he's on a really funny one of their digital teams called Brinkman, Jason Shabiro. He took me, we're huge professional wrestling fans, and he took me to go see the show Cage Match, which you host here.
Yeah, I'm one of the hosts of the Cage Match here.
But the one and the show Cage Match, I mean, everyone listening to this knows what Cage Match is, right?
Yeah. Well, I would assume.
Essentially, it's a show where they put two improv teams up against each other, and then the audience votes for which team they want to come back the next week.
Mm-hmm.
But in between it, they do like a bits, right? Uh-huh. But in New York, in here, it's like a post-apocalyptic wasteland, right? But in New York, it's a professional wrestling show. So like at the top, they'll have like announcers come out and, you know, like a fake wrestler come out. And we're huge wrestling fans. So my friend was like, we got to go see this wrestling show.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even go for the improv. We went to just see. So think about like your show, if people just come for the, like they don't want to see the improv at all.
They just want to see the bits that we do.
Yeah. Which is like what percentage of the audience? It's low because they want to see like a specific team. Not to knock your talents, you guys are great.
Oh, no, I get it, definitely. Yeah. I don't want to hear us talk for a whole show either.
Right. It's like going to Herald Night for the hosting bits.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so we went to see that. It was awesome because Charlie Todd was doing this character, Chuck McMahon, which was like a spoof on Vince McMahon. Mm-hmm. And it was just really funny. But then I happened to see the improv, and I saw a team called Hot Sauce, which is Adam Pally, yeah. Gil Azari, and Ben Schwartz. And I instantly was like, it was like the funniest thing I ever saw. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow. And then every single Thursday, I kept voting for them. They were on a huge run that summer. And I just watched every single week until they lost. But and then I just graduated college. And I was like, oh, when I'm done with college, I'm going to go in New York and be a stand-up. And then I saw that show and was like, oh, I'm going to sign up for UCB class. And then I just started doing improv. Like, I connected more with improv. I was doing stand-up also, but the improv, I caught that improv bug really hard.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so early on, how did you feel about it? Like, was it something that when you started doing it, like, it was like, oh man, I just love this thing? Or was it like hard for you? Or were you like, this is tough? Like, how did you feel
early
about
on?
It?
I was into it from the get-go. Like, right away, I was like, I'm doing this. I was started watching Harold Knight, mm-hmm. and was like, I have to do this. Like, there was nothing in my brain that was like, I'm going to quit at any point. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, I have to achieve that goal. I was like very determined. Mm-hmm. But I did feel some weird feelings of being like out of place in my own city. Mm-hmm. You know, like I got ripped on for sounding like a New Yorker a lot. And I was like, this is my place. Uh-huh. But UCB is like its own island mm-hmm. within Manhattan of like theater, you know, people. I didn't take theater in college. I mean, I took like a few acting classes and stuff, but I was like a business major mm-hmm. and didn't hang around theater people. So you get to UCB, like level 101, you know, the lower levels are a lot of actors and theater people and, uh-huh. and the occasional divorcee. So I did feel like weirded out, and it was my first time doing a lot of these like corny exercises, you know, yeah. like playing like zip, zap, zop and all that stuff. And I just remember being like, at that point in my life, you know, I was kind of like coming out of college where I was like a meathead and stuff like that. And so it was definitely like out of place, but I never for a second, even that, none of it shook me. I was very determined, mm-hmm. you know?
All right. Because it's funny that you mentioned that because like, you know, I've seen you enough, you know, like I can't say like I'm just well versed in Dan Black, but seen a lot of your shows.
You're not a fan.
Well, no, I'm just kidding. but it is that thing of being like, strike me as someone who is like a very like you improviser. Because I don't want to say specific because it makes it I feel like it seems like it's limiting you, but it is like it does feel like whenever I do see you do improv, it is like, that's Dan Black doing improv. I don't know how, like, so when you say like, you know,
I've heard this before. Yeah. I know what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Will Hines, one time I did play by play. You've done that show?
Yes, I've done it a couple times.
And that's like the show where there's Will Hines and out here it's Alex Ferney, right?
Or Susie Barrett.
Yeah, or Susie. And they'll sit on the side and you'll do an improv scene and they'll like do commentary on it. Mm-hmm. And then I remember like the first time I did it, I think I only did it one time, but I came out and I just said a line and it felt like it was a pretty innocuous, regular line. And then Will was like, there's Dan Black working on this character he's been working on his whole life. You know, it's like a big, huge, huge laugh. So I know what you're saying. I feel like I have my own approach. Mm-hmm. I found early on in improv that being myself was helpful.
Yeah.
You know, that mm-hmm. I had a specific enough, you know, specific, I don't see it as a bad thing.
Yeah.
Like a specific enough point of view on things where I was like, I'm gonna stick to what I know a little bit.
Yeah.
And bring what I can to a scene as opposed to, I learned early on that pretending to not be who I was uncomfortable. Not that I'm saying I can't play a character, but I always try to play through a veil of who I am.
Yeah.
You know, and I think a lot of the improvisers I respect are similar.
Mm-hmm.
Had that approach of like, this is who I am, this is my comedic voice, and I can still be engulfed in a scene and not have to lose myself.
Yeah, I know. I think that's great. I think it's great for people to hear, like, listeners, where it is like sometimes people is like, well, you know, to be an improviser, you do have to kind of like, you know, you want to do all these different things. And of course, obviously, you do want to like expand to make sure you're not being stale or just like resting on your laurels or whatnot. But it is that thing of being like, but also don't be afraid to just speak through your own voice and your own experiences. Like, I feel like that is something that does shine through. Like, even when you are labeled as some sort of a character, like, it is like, well, even if I'm doing this thing, I'm still doing it through my own voice, you know, like, yeah, like my own base of how I'm like, of what I'm comfortable with.
Sure. And I think that's specific to improv. Mm-hmm. You know, I, like you said, we mentioned Maud, and I've done, you know, I had a running show at the theater, like a solo show. And in that stuff, sometimes I'll play, you know, a character who's not me. Mm-hmm. But when you're improvising, you're in the moment, I think it's really helpful to play. We always say play top of your intelligence.
Yeah.
Well, I play the top of my intelligence, wherever that is.
Yeah, yesterday, your team Strobe Bros played Cage Match. Really good show, really fun show, and it was
we lost. Let's call a spade a spade.
Okay, well, you did lose, but to be fair to you, the people who did win, Hibeki Drysdale, are on I think that was win number 39, so they're on a run. So like,
oh yeah, sure.
So obviously, you didn't lose to some smucks, but and so that was a mono scene, right?
Yes,
that was a mono scene. And what's interesting about that is like when you're improv, when you're approaching improv, like how do you approach it? Are you approaching it in a sense of being like, you know, the varying levels of like, oh, okay, like I'm going to be serious. This is, I'm going to be, you know, like I'm going to be a little bit more silly. Like I'm going to be like, what is your approach when
I think my approach? I think my approach is to, I attempt to improvise from a grounded place, mm-hmm, initially. I enjoy start. I think you get, it's really satisfying. Well, you mentioned mono scene,
mm-hmm,
and I'm the one who said let's do a mono scene for our group,
because
mm-hmm, I think with that amount of time, you can really start slow and build to something really fun,
mm-hmm,
and earn it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's very it's satisfying. So I think so just giving off the fact that I choose that, and this is changing constantly, my approach to improv.
Uh-huh.
You know, sometimes I'm in a mood where I'm like, I just got, you know, just have fun. Mm-hmm. But I think being grounded, I like flawed people. I like mm-hmm, coming from a place of why is this person, you know, and anytime I coach improv, I'm always focused on why. It's huge to me. It's like, why is this character do I understand enough about this person's unusualness to move this scene forward in a way where, like, I want to be this character?
Uh-huh.
So that's kind of how I focus. Like, do I know enough? So if you want to bring up the show from last night, I didn't love my character in that set, but it's okay because I ended up becoming more of the straight man in it. Uh-huh. I don't know if speaking about that set is so specific because not anyone listening to this saw it, but I was thinking, like, okay, who is this person?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and why do I have a good justification for my unusualness or my place in this set? Like, why am I here, and how do I serve it? You know, so I don't know. I know I'm giving you a bunch of different answers.
I mean, but I feel like that's just.
But I think
improv.
I come from a place of why, because I want to play ground. I'm attempting to play grounded. Doesn't mean it's not fun or mm-hmm, can be silly. I'm tempted to play grounded, and the way I like to approach doing that is by knowing my character's why, or like my motivation,
uh-huh,
my justification for whatever's happening mm-hmm in the scenes. Because I feel like you can expand on that and you'll want to stay in the scene.
Yeah. I mean, even once again, even referencing the show from last night, it was one of those things where, like, you saying you didn't like your character or whatnot, but it was still that thing of being like, when you did become the straight man, you know, especially like as the scene, as it was winding down, where it was like, solely what you were doing was just like reacting very real to a situation where it is like this is crazy. Like, why are you doing right. this? Like, what is like,
yes.
it was that thing where it was almost like, yeah, you were kind of doing that thing, but it was like, that seemed so necessary for what was going on.
I love that you brought this up because last night, that actually was one of my favorite improv moments that I can remember was, and it happened yesterday, which is weird. First off, that's because of performing with those people. Mm-hmm. Like that's, I was performing with Strobros, which is, Monstro was my first Harold team, and half of us live in LA now. We were a New York Harold team, mm-hmm. and then half of us live here now, and it's the half that live here.
Uh-huh.
So, and when we were Harold team, we were so nervous and like young, and we always joke about it. Like we were just, we like, didn't have that much. We had fun. We loved each other. But we, on stage, we were just so nervous about like being cut and that opportunity, you know, the stakes of that. That now when we play together, we're like so far removed from it. We have so much fun and do such like fun shows. I have such like a deep affection for those people.
Uh-huh.
But this moment in that scene was also like we're talking about why. Mm-hmm. What you're saying is Beth Appel's character – in the, you know, explaining improv is, by the way, specific improv scenes,
yeah.
never funny. Yeah. But
but this is what this is about, so it's, at least it's going to be interesting to the point that you're going to make
but
afterwards.
The point I, right, yeah. I was going to make is that she did something unusual, which is she just out of nowhere started jamming a popsicle stick like repeatedly down Sarah Claspel's throat, like just jamming it. And then she did the same thing to Paul Welsh like a second later. And then this for a second, the scene started to move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, no. Like, why did you do that?
Yeah.
And I just kept asking her, like, why did you do that? I will not move. Let this scene go forward until you tell me why. You're crazy. That was the craziest thing that I ever saw in my entire life. You took the popsicle. You started jamming it down her throat. Why? And so... then I was just begging Beth for a justification. She's somebody I know can handle like being put on the spot as hard as possible. Like Beth Appel's great, and her and then she it went on forever. Her justification was, I guess I'm just crazy, which is the worst. We all like the first rule of improv. It's like the worst justification for an unusual thing. Is that like I'm just crazy? Because right then there's no philosophy to it, so you can't really. You're like, oh, you're just nuts. So the moves are going to be random and not like heightened in some kind of uniform way.
Yeah, exactly.
So I just challenged her even more. Yeah. I was like, no. And my character just admitted that I was homosexual in the set, and so I was like, I just like admitted the most deep thing about myself. Mm-hmm. Like we're opening up, like right now, dig inside yourself and find out like what is the justification for your unusual behavior right now. Mm-hmm. And then her response was, I guess I'm just generally a crazy person. And it was deep. We had the game of giving no justification. Yeah. So like on a meta way, I loved it so much. Because it was like she knew it's. I think it's such like a deep improv move to give a bad give the bad move, but then stick to it to the point that it becomes a game. There's someone who, and I just loved it because I never had the game be justifying.
Yeah, but that's the thing that was very interesting about that thing where it was like I think you know in improv we are kind of taught to be like oh, okay like you accept the justifications or whatnot like once it's like once to you it's like okay that's even if I don't necessarily believe it as myself as this character like it's good enough for us to move on or whatnot.
Yeah,
but I think in something like that when it is like you can like really kind of let stuff breathe and like or like you know really kind of like sit in stuff a little bit or like explore things a little bit more because you
that's
got the time.
When I'm teaching justification to people, it's really difficult. I also think it's one of the most overlooked things in improv, like because I think it's huge. It's huge, and I think. Is that you just hit it on the head. It's do you have enough information? Does the scene make enough sense to move it forward?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do I have enough of your why? Whether you like it or not, will I buy it to go forward?
Uh-huh.
And that moment, we couldn't go forward. And that was the joke, that she was halting it purposely going forward. I'd probably only get away with that at a cage match audience. Mm-hmm. But yes, so... yeah, do you like your justification? I think it's like, oh, well, I don't know. I don't know if you have a choice. You kind of when you get one. But does it make enough sense? Or you need more?
Yeah.
I think a lot of times is really important for Harold team, for an improv scene, especially in a Harold, because if you got to do a second beat of something, you better sure it has to make enough sense.
Yeah.
I
just even recently, semi-recently, where it was like That idea of being like, yeah, like if someone gets your justification, if that justification isn't enough, then who says that you have to go, okay, great. Like if you feel like, no, I need more than this, it's okay to be like, I know you just gave a justification, but honestly, it's not good enough for me. And it is that thing of being like, oh, okay, like being pushed to really kind of like solidify like, what exactly what it means.
Does it make enough sense? Like if you're going, I call it like the why chain, mm-hmm. right? So if I say to you, this is the horrible example that I give sometimes. I'll just be like, if I say to you, if I'm like eating like shit off the ground, mm-hmm. and then you say, like, hey, why are you eating shit? And then I say, because I'm hungry. Mm-hmm. We have a justification. Right? Uh-huh. Like you have a justification, but do you feel satisfied? No.
No.
No, because why aren't you eating regular food? Uh-huh. So you need, it needs a follow back. Like it needs a follow up. Mm-hmm. It needs pushback. First of all, that's not a funny scene at all. Mm-hmm. It's terrible. Yeah. But the example is like there's more less extreme examples of that where we accept a why for ourselves and we're like, this feels all right, I guess this is what I got. So I have to just be a vessel for this why. It's like, mm-hmm. no, push back and get. And I know a lot of times if you just get one more, if you drill down one more level of why mm-hmm. in your scene, you crack like a nut where it's like, oh, wow, I went from two-dimensional to three-dimensional.
Yeah.
Where you'll want this scene to be a mono scene because you want to stay this character.
Uh-huh.
You want to be the person who is like in denial about this or is coming from a place of I'm hiding something, or I'm a victim of this. You know what I mean? Yeah. I just said all the most negative justifications possible, but yeah.
I mean, well, so then let me ask you then this, because you've been on a number of different Herald teams.
Four, let's be exact. Here.
Okay, you've been on four Herald teams. One you were on for a month, you said.
Yeah, surfing. Your favorite team, man.
Yeah, my favorite team, surfing. Before you were then moved to like...
You loved it as like a verb. Like,
yeah, I don't know, just the thing of surfing, just, I don't know, just like, because it's such a thing to be like, oh, yo, God, you want to be surfing? Well, surfing it is, like, yeah. And then, like, but what would you say was your approach to Heralds from, let's say, Monstro, where you even talked about a little bit of being, like, nervous like this, to, like, when you finally felt like, oh, I'm kind of comfortable with this thing, like?
My approach to Herald, why am I hesitating? Mm-hmm. I think my approach to Herald was making sure that we had good games in the first beat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that's not like it's not a groundbreaking answer. Uh-huh. It's kind of like the obvious thing, but I think my approach to Herald was putting like a heavy emphasis on first beats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just being and I did almost have a look out for myself attitude, uh-huh. which it sucks to. I think that's why I'm hesitating, because I'm like, I think you have to be like, yeah, like, okay, this is my scene, right? Like, man, I'm hesitating here because I don't want to, because it's not totally true, but there is a thing where if you can have a good first beat for your Herald, you kind of like did your job,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And I think that was my thing. It was like, all right, the scene that I'm in, now, and I'm not talking about support. I supported other first beats, but it's kind of like, all right, if I'm taking a beat, I always saw Herald like that.
Mm-hmm.
We do our opening, and then there's eight of us. And then two people don't take a first beat,
mm-hmm.
right? Obviously, if you start as a three-person scene, whatever, but generally, if you're starting as a two-person scene, I'm like, for my beat, I want to do whatever I can to make sure we walk out of that first beat with a game so that no matter what happens, our second beat rocks.
Yeah.
And then when we have a game right away, I want to blow out that first beat so hard that you don't know where we're going in the second beat.
Uh-huh.
You know? So I guess what I'm saying is that there's a little bit of being like, I'm going to take care of this group by being like, make my beat great.
Yeah.
You know?
I think.
But I think there's this thing where I think I like to take responsibility. I think mm-hmm. that was like my approach to Herald. It was like, I'm going to take some responsibility for my part of this without being too controlling, where you're like, I'm going to branch out and try to be the hero of the Herald. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Like, there's a fine line there where you see the guy on the back line who's like, I'm going to justify every scene from the back line,
mm-hmm.
where I saw it as like the way to not play selfish was like be really sink into my beat. Because I'm somebody who got the notes of like, hey, you're walking onto every scene.
Uh-huh.
Like Chris Gethard was like pulling me back constantly. He was like stopping Herald to be like, Dan, you're like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. You're in every single one of these. So I had to like take my excitement, my energy towards being very proactive in the Herald to like want it, you know, wanting to be like the hero of the Herald, to just be like, I'm gonna, for my piece, I'm going to harness all that energy into making it great. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that that helps, like that thing of being like, if I'm gonna, I feel like Herald is such a, everything is such a connected thing. If like you have a bad beat, it, even though the percentages aren't necessarily something that we that, that's concrete, it is like if we have a bad beat, there's a good chance that the next beat might not be that strong either.
Yeah.
Just but if you have a strong beat, the next beat possibly could be strong just because the energy of that other beat is like, you know, I so I always feel like if I have a good beat, there's a good chance that the next beats will also be good because it's a, just a good starting point to be like, oh, that was a good scene.
Right.
That's another good scene.
If you have a good first beat, it has a solid game to it, then you can heighten it because people know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of times you do a scene where it's like, that was, we just like coasted our way through that on our charm.
Mm-hmm.
And then, for your, you know, you can get in trouble in those second beats. So it's always about like, how do I, walk away from that first beat with a game?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And also the opening, I mean, it's helpful to have good premises from your opening.
This is very true.
Yeah.
Is this something that I'm on a team now, and it's something that we that is still like, okay, well, are we making sure that we're having some solid premises to pull from when we pull out in these openings? So you know, obviously, you said you walked onto every scene, or you walked onto a lot of scenes, especially early on. Like, when did you think you were, at what point in your Herald career did you go like, all right, I feel really strong about Heralds. Like, I feel like really good about these Heralds.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I felt good. Well, I'll say this, is that my Herald team was, when we got placed on Montreux, we were a bunch of people, I think most people had auditioned 3 times at least already,
mm-hmm.
which at that time wasn't a lot. I mean, there were people who auditioned, I remember like Gil Ozerio auditioned 5 times. Kevin Hines auditioned 5 times. Like, a lot of people auditioned a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
But there was this sense of people I was performing with were put on before me.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? And I thought that was the best thing ever. Like, that's one of the pieces of advice I give to people when you're worried about being placed, is like, just get good.
Uh-huh.
'Cause the best thing that happened to me was that I probably could have got placed on a year before, but then they made me wait another year.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was helpful. So my point is that I had already been in front of a lot of people as teachers who you know, make the teams, who are noting the teams. And I felt like they had confidence in me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very helpful. So right out the gate, I didn't feel amazing. But I felt proficient. You know what I mean? Where some people get placed very early and are like, and then almost learn on Herald Night.
Yeah.
I felt like I learned off of Herald Night.
Uh-huh.
I learned in like advanced study show. There's the, you know, what were they called at the time? They were, you know, the 600 classes or whatever. Now they're called like advanced show. I don't even know what they're called.
Out here, like advanced studies, or
there's
even
advanced
like
study
small
and advanced study performance.
Okay.
The ASPs, right?
Yeah.
Like those. I felt like that's where I did a lot of my learning. So when we got into Herald Night, but then the moment where I felt solidified was, Anthony King was the artistic director of UCB
mm-hmm.
when I was coming up in New York, and he was great. I feel very fortunate to come up under his watch,
uh-huh.
you know, and because he was at a no bullshit attitude, and people respected his opinion. I'm not saying that, you know, people respect the other artistic directors, and people respect my and stuff like that. I'm just saying he was very good at playing that role where I just had a lot of respect for him,
mm-hmm.
you know? I had, like, whatever daddy issues you had with the artistic director. And so after the first – my Herald team existed for, like, 1 full year, basically, and then they were doing shakeups. And then he gave me a call when they were, like, switching the teams up and told me that people were getting cut. I was hearing it all day. Everyone's on G-Chat. I had, like, my day job at the time. And he called me and said, hey, I'm going to put you on another team. And I'm, like, really happy with your progress. And, like, I don't see you as a guy who's just funny up there. I think you're really good at playing game,
mm-hmm.
you know, and, like, you're a good improviser.
Mm-hmm.
That was a huge moment for me because I always – I came up sometimes feeling like I'm doing it wrong. And
uh-huh.
Chris Gethard even – he sent me an email that I have that's one of the longest emails that I own. Do you own email? I mean, Google probably owns your email.
It's just true, but you kept. That's like, this is one that I can find this easily than other ones, or that you didn't delete it.
Right, yeah. Right. He sent me this email. It was very long. That was like, hey, look, you're gonna have to learn how to do improv correctly, like extra hard. Mm-hmm. Because people are laughing at you in class. Like, they're laughing, not like at me in a way where like, but I guess it is essentially that.
Yeah.
You know, Chris Gethard, I'm very grateful. He gave me a lot of hard truths, in my time. And he told me, like, you're going to have to learn to be, like, good at it. And he compared me to some people that he came up with, mm-hmm. which was flattering, but also interesting, of being like, hey, you will be able to get laughs, but you want to do this correctly. Like, I see you taking this seriously. So it's important to recognize a good laugh from a bad laugh, really. Uh-huh. So then that's why that call from – so I got that, and then I got placed on a team. And I remember when I got placed on a team that I wasn't, like, unanimous for putting him on a team.
Uh-huh.
You know, I kind of got, like, some inside information.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I'm saying that phone call, I think, was that moment for me where I was like, oh, okay, I've – been accepted as a good improviser,
uh-huh.
as well as someone who just is a goof. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
So then being on those teams and all of a sudden being taken off that team and essentially being put on, like, because Death by Ruru was like a weekend team, right?
Yeah, they performed on Saturday night.
So then being on a team like that, what was that experience like?
That was really cool, obviously. It's my favorite team. I'd go watch Ruru. They were Friday nights at 11. And I'd watch, like, Brett Gelman and Curtis Quinn and Tamanik and Jackie Clark. And I'm not even mentioning people because I'm on the spot. But, at that time, they were, like, amazing. It blew my mind. Like, I was always like, oh, man. I didn't even think it would be possible to perform with any of these people. I mean, Neil Casey, obviously. And then I started. What happened was I performed Ass Cat for the first time in New York, and I was and a bunch of the Ruru guys were regular performers at Ass Cat, so I kind of got to perform with them beforehand, and that. So I'm saying like that was awesome. I mean, my goal was to, you know, I dreamed of like performing in ASCAT.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that happened first before I was at Ruru. So I got to perform with all those guys and I always felt like I'm auditioning for a Ruru spot.
Uh-huh.
Once I did that. Cuz I knew all these guys were moving to LA, mm-hmm. you know, and there's spots constantly opening up. And well, not constantly. It was rare. I don't always constantly. But enough where there would be spots,
uh-huh.
you know. So, yeah, so I felt like, oh, I had to, every time I was performing in ASCAT, I was like, felt in my back of my mind that I was auditioning for Ruru.
Uh-huh.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So then when they finally asked me to sit in, it kind of felt like, it didn't feel like, oh, I'm auditioning for them, although maybe it was.
Uh-huh.
But then I got placed and it was like I already had been performing with them, so it felt really natural. So it was cool. Yeah, it was awesome. It was the highlight of my improv career will always be the couple years I performed on Saturday nights with Ruru. Like, mm-hmm. that was the best.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, that was something I never took for granted the whole time. I was thinking about moving to LA when I was placed on Ruru, and mm-hmm. I had an internal dialogue with myself, just being like, you worked really hard on this art form for a long time. Just, like, enjoy it.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like, because I have such a hard time enjoying things.
Uh-huh.
I think a lot of people do in this business, you know?
Oh, definitely.
Right? And especially being a Jew, doesn't help. and also my parents live like 25 minutes out of the city,
uh-huh.
and they would come on Saturday nights. Not every Saturday night, but a lot of Saturday nights. And I was like, they're coming all the time. And I knew my move to LA was imminent, you know, and then even if it was like 2 years down the line. So I really was like, I really focused on like it being like, oh, my parents get to watch me perform and we go out to dinner beforehand and I perform with people like Neil Casey and Anthony and Tamanik, uh-huh. you know, Gavin Spieler, like all those guys like that I respected so much, Chad Carter. Yeah, that I like, you know, I think that was like my improv dream. That was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't remember what the question was, but
I mean, I think you answered it. So
performing for a weekend crowd was always something I really wanted to do because
uh-huh.
you get to a point where you perform in a Harold night for an improv crowd. You want to perform. I want to compete with stand-ups.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Like I, and then I toured with UCB, so that also hit that and did the touring company. Because I think improv is amazing. I think when improv is great, it's the best thing you can watch. Uh-huh. So that's why I like performing for a weekend crowd, because I want to perform with people who heard UCB's cool, and then we show them
why
what this
cool.
art is, you know? Using the word art is so douchey, but...
I mean, yeah, I think we get it. Like, I mean, especially here, no one's going to... Well, they might roll their eyes, but we all understand that this is an art form.
Yeah.
Performance
art.
It is some form of performance art.
You know, like, that's what I'm saying, is that I also always saw myself as a comedian, mm-hmm. right? I see myself as a comedian. I do stand-up now, and I always respected comedians, so... You know, like that's why I want this to be not something that's just done for itself. Like, I don't like it being self-contained.
Mm-hmm. Just like other improvisers. It's like that thing, other improvisers are just basically supporting other improvisers as opposed to being like, people who come outside of it who don't do improv or comedy still enjoy this thing that I'm doing.
Yeah. And that's like, to me, that's the target audience of what should be the target audience of UCB or whatever. You know, and I think it is. Is people who want to see comedy on a Saturday night.
Uh-huh.
They go and they're like, oh, we could go to the stand-up show, but like, that improv stuff's great. Uh-huh. Let's go to that. You know?
Yeah.
I love when I hear that somebody is like thinks UCB is stand-up. Like someone who buys an ASCAT ticket and thinks that they're going to see stand-up. And then they see it and they're like, that was awesome.
Uh-huh.
That seems like the ideal people to perform for me.
Yeah, those are great. Anytime I get to perform like on a Friday night or a Saturday night, UCB, it is always like you do get to. It is that feeling of like, oh, these aren't necessarily. There might be a couple of different people in the audience. It's like, oh, those are people that come to Harold Night too. But it's also people where it's just like who you just are just there to see a show. So the laugh is even different. Like, because even if you do that same thing on Harold Night and this still gets the laugh, the laugh of it feels different than it does from a crowd that knows improv and a crowd who doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the cool things is that when I was on the touring company, you'd go into like a few times I've done what are those like student orientations? Mm-hmm. It's like a bunch of like freshmen or like sophomores, or, you know, who come in and they have to. They're like required to show up to this thing, but they'll like throw UCB at the end.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Uh-huh. It'll be like, all right, everyone, just so you know, like here's where all the help centers are. Here's where the infirmary is. And like, also, we got the UCB for you. You don't have to stay if you don't want, but it's rare. And so you come you think you're part of like, you're essentially like a dare like presentation. Uh-huh. You know, you're like, right? Like you're. Doing, remember when you're a kid and you see like assemblies?
Oh, yeah.
You're part of an assembly. And then we come up there and you see people like with their arms crossed and like a bunch of like cool dudes. Uh-huh. And then we start doing improv and they're like, you see them get into it.
Mm-hmm.
I've always enjoyed that. I always see them be like, oh, this is funny.
Uh-huh.
This is like a funny show. This isn't clean. This is just where, you know, we were like interview somebody and show you like a really funny show. You know, I don't know. I always like got off on that in an improv way.
Uh-huh. Well, so like you said it was imminent, and it was. You did move here to LA.
I did. Yeah, yeah. I've been here 2 years as of like 2 days ago.
All right. Well, congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
So knowing that you were coming from the New York community where you kind of had like solidified yourself there and coming into a new space, like I know there's a lot of New York people here that know you from there, but just as a whole, like a community who doesn't really know you, what was that?
There's not a lot of surfing fans in LA. The real surfing.
Yeah.
Except for actual surfing. Look, it's nerve-wracking, you know. Mm. It's not only I moved from my home theater, I also moved from my home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, my whole family is in New York. I lived on the East Coast my whole life. I came out to LA like two or three times, and, you know, not for like long stays. But at the point, you know, at the point I moved, a lot of my friends are out here.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lot of people I know are out here at this point. So it wasn't like moving to like South Dakota or something.
Uh-huh.
You know, it is a transfer. And I'm fortunate. I think I'm one of the fortunate examples of people who move here because I was able to jump on the Fucked Up Family show on Friday nights because that's like an extension of Ruru New York. Mm-hmm. And they were really welcoming to me there. And I do Tuesday clubs on Tuesday night. Mm-hmm. And now I'm performing on a mod team. So I think, like, you know, I've had a smooth transition. I mean, LA is full of great talent. Like, this theater is awesome. Mm-hmm. It is. I do wish there was a better way to, like, unite the theaters. I mean, we have DCM. I don't know if there's an easy way to do it, you know. And I think that it is pretty. It is done probably the best it can with the resources there are. But I know there's a lot of great New York performers here that nobody knows. That, like, not that no one knows them, but they're, you know, this theater's a tough nut to crack. Yeah. If you put you know, and you put your time in, and you play on Harold Knight in New York, and then you come out here. And then it's like, what are you going to start in classes again? Yeah. Or, you know, so I think that that's a gray area. But there's Spank System, and there's a lot of New York performers here at this point. So I think you just have to grind it a little bit. But it is like, you hear about it in New York, like moving to LA, like, you know, just be like, yeah, it's a whole other theater, you know?
Yeah, I think it's funny both ways, because when you do come to the other place, because I've been to DCM and I've done some stuff to where, like, I'm playing with people from over there. Like, I've done a couple of things like that for DCM and whatnot. And everyone is nice, but it is that thing where it's like, yeah, because either way it goes, if you come here, people are still nice to you, but there is still that air of being like, all right, but don't think you're just going to come over here and, like, take the spots we've been working. You know, like,
it does feel like that.
Yeah, it does. And it's not necessarily that 100%. It might be a little bit of that in the air. But it's like, but when you are genuinely good, like, people go like, all right, like, all right, he's good.
And yeah, I think that's true. Mm-hmm. I think there is a thing of proving yourself. And I think it's nothing to do with the theater administration or anything. Mm-hmm. It's just natural human behavior. Like, you're introducing another person in here who's claiming they're a specific level that they haven't proven to you. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're going to be like, all right, let me check this guy out.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
So, yeah, I just sympathize with anyone who has to take steps backwards. Uh-huh. just in general.
Yeah,
I'm a compassionate person in that way.
I think you're somebody who came here with a little bit of lore. Like, I think people come from New York, and I don't know, I probably would say that I don't think it's the reverse. Like, if LA was to go to New York, if that happens that much. But I always feel like, because New York is the main theater, and you would feel like, even like the UCB for themselves claim, like, New York theater, it's like, that's UCB right there.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so when people come from there, from here, it is a thing of being like, oh, did you, Dan Black, you know Dan Black's in town? He's like, he was an improviser in New York. He played for Death by Ruru.
Right.
And it's like, oh, Dan Black. And he's like, oh, who is this guy that everyone's like championing? And that happens not just with you, but with other people who come from there. So, like, it is that thing of being like, oh, okay, seeing that kind of, like, seeing, like, hearing about it and then witnessing it and going like, oh, okay, like, all right, he's good. Like, I see that thing. So coming from there to here, do you think, like, while improvising, do you think the audience experience is different? Or, like,
I think, So I think, just to summarize, the last thing is just, I think everyone was really great to me.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone was awesome to me. Mike was great to me. Moving here, like, I think that in general, it's a positive experience, people who transfer over. It's just natural. There's a lot of people here, you know, mm-hmm. and I think you just have to work a little harder to shine, probably. But performing here, yes, I think the audience is, well, look, the audiences I seem in LA seem more sensitive,
mm-hmm.
I think. But I do hate being the guy who, like, talks about the difference, you know, like, speaking about the difference between audiences. Like, I don't, like, I follow the old, like, Chris Rock thing about, like, not blaming the audience.
Yeah.
Though me and Mike the other night had a conversation where we were like, that scene was funny, right? Like, why didn't they laugh? We did the scene, we thought, it was funny. And obviously audiences differ from, you know, from here to there. But we, you know, I came from doing a particularly dark, shocking show. Like, we did in New York, the Fucked Up Family show. And, you know, we literally would interview people about people who were, like, rape victims or, like, you know, or people who, like, lost their whole family in car accidents and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw it as, like, therapeutic. We wouldn't force anybody up on stage.
Yeah.
But we'd do shows on that, and I think we had a built-in audience there for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it's, like, a New York, L.A. thing, mm-hmm. but I know, like, when we did the Fucked Up Family show here – there's a few things I noticed is that, like, people were less willing to share some dark stuff. It also felt like some people were not, didn't feel like they even understood themselves in some way. But there's some of that, that's in New York too. We started saying there was rules like no one under 25 was allowed to get interviews because they couldn't express themselves. We broke that all the time. But yeah, so I just think, from doing that show and touching on sensitive things, there is a feeling that like, in New York, people were more acceptable of going there and they'll go there with you. And here it seems a little bit less. But I don't even know if that's, I don't know. I don't want to be the guy who like says that. That's just that's how it feels.
Well, I am an LA improviser through and through, and yes. I will support you in this in saying that it does feel like, even from an improviser standpoint, it is that thing of being like, when you see improvisers who come from New York, you do see that. And I think I read this even on a wiki thing of yours where it is like an unapologetic like commitment to like whatever that thing is, whether if it's the darkness of a scene or something
right.
And I do think that sometimes even though here people can play it real, they don't necessarily play it real. Like, it's very rare that people play it real to the extreme.
Yes.
So then when you do see somebody do it, it feels like, whoa, like what? Like it feels new because no one really ever really goes that far with it. Because I guess rather out of like fear or that people won't accept you if you go too dark or whatever. And I do feel like sometimes you see that with a lot more like a New York trained improvisers who come here.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily know if that's the thing where it's like, yeah, in New York, we really do go, we're more prone to going dark a lot.
I think that is true. Mm-hmm. I think that is true. I think also when I was coming up in the theater, it was during the big, like, ironic detachment. What do you want to call it? Like, fear? Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Like, scare? Uh-huh. The ironic detachment scare? And I remember, like, Besser giving, like, lectures. That was the big thing. He, like, a DCM press conference. Like, that's what he was speaking about. And it was during my most impressionable time as an improviser. And I remember him explain that and having like a legit fear about not taking things seriously and not really processing. And I think that's something that happened last night. We go back to the thing that happened with Beth. Like, mm-hmm. I really, in that moment, said she just took a popsicle and started jamming it down that woman's throat. Mm-hmm. And like everyone laughed and I think we could have moved forward.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, no, I don't want to be detached from that. Yeah. I don't know if it's not the best example of like ironic detachment,
but it fits.
But it does fit where it's like, why did you're insane. Like, I was, and I was getting a big response from the crowd, like, just being like, you're fucking crazy. Do you curse on this podcast?
Yeah, I mean, you just did, so to
speak. Yeah. Well, I'll beep it out. Make more work for you. But, like, just be like, you're fucking insane. You are the craziest person I ever met. Yeah. Like, go sit over there. I don't want to be around you. Uh-huh. Like, we might have to tie you up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just like, we might have, because of what you just did. So I think that probably comes from that place, like, where I say, like, grounded, and then I asked for why. Like, that's what I did. So I was watching a scene the other day. I coached one of the mess hall teams. It was, I think, yesterday. And one of the improvisers was doing a scene where he was, like, he was going to shoot heroin before his baby was being born.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of just like, yeah, I'm going to do some heroin, like, because, like, when my kid comes out, then, like, I can't be irresponsible or whatever.
Yeah.
But I was like, and then it like we kind of moved the scene forward. We're looking for other things. And I was like, wait, let's like process. He's going to do like heroin.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, man, like I understand that. But like, do you have to do heroin? Are you a heroin user?
Uh-huh.
Like, can we, me and you go to like a strip club right now? Like, get out here and do something that's like a little more, right? Because like that's like the most extreme thing.
Yeah.
And we didn't push back like that. And it was like, oh, now our scene is detached. Now it's a goofy scene already.
Uh-huh.
And that was two lines in.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no.
So I think that I'm saying, I don't know if it's New York, whatever, or, we could talk about it. But I know that, like, in New York when I was coming up, and a lot of the people that you see that are New York improvisers are, like, are, even if they're older than me, they were still in the span where we were really focused that time, where that was the big focus, is, like, really treating things real.
Yeah.
I think even in Chicago improvisers, I think, are probably even more the extreme.
Uh-huh.
Though I'm always trying to crack Chicago. I think if I ever hit it big, I want to like go to Chicago, take some improv classes. I'm always curious about how people are trained in Chicago.
Yeah,
like without game, without the concept of game, because all game is just like, what's funny about the scene?
Yeah.
I'm always like, well, how do you heighten this idea? But then I watch some Chicago improvisers who like, I perform with them, you know, in ASCAT in New York, I perform with a lot of Chicago improvisers and they like blow my mind.
Yeah.
With how they, you know, and I was like, oh, well, what are they, but I can't crack what they're doing. You know, yeah, and I think like I went to school for accounting, so I think that's probably my brain want like, well, I got like everything is solvable, you know?
Yeah.
Like how can I spreadsheet like John Lutz? How can I, you know, like how can I figure out what his code is? And it's not like how it works.
Yeah, I think it feels like because they don't necessarily talk about game the way the UCB talks about game.
Yeah.
But they do acknowledge that in their scenes inherently is some sort of game. They're just not saying like this is game. But I think it is, I think, of being like they're like you see a lot of that stuff where it is like they're making choices. And as opposed to kind of sometimes where we see a lot of these scenes as teachers and coaches or whatnot, where it is like we're kind of doing this grab bag character of being like, oh, I'm kind of doing this, but then I'll do something else that doesn't necessarily fit within the parameters of the kind of character you set up for yourself originally.
Right, 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 right.
And I feel like with them, even though they're not necessarily playing game, they're so they stick to kind of like whatever the thing is that they chose. Yeah, the truth of whatever the thing that they chose and really kind of exploring that in that way where it is very it's game based in the sense of being like, well, you know what my character is about. It's not necessarily being like, well, you just said that you don't eat chicken and now you're eating chicken or whatever kind of weird.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay. Or if you were to do that, then you would explain that. It wouldn't be just some sort of like flub in the scene where it's like, well, that's just something that happens now. Like it's something where it's like, well, if I'm doing this, it's now for a reason. I feel like they really do unpack a lot of that stuff because they're not focused on game. They're focused on like, you know, the scene or the environment or whatever language they put on it, which is interesting because it is that thing of just being like something to really think about that I think UCB says to you where it is like, yeah, I mean, we do teach this kind of thing, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to kind of now like neglect all the other aspects of improv just because we centrally teach this one thing. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And acting and just commitment and scene commitment in general.
Mm-hmm. I'm always surprised at being like, yeah, like, you know what, when I come off of scenes like, what, you know, what, like, that was okay, but like, I should have been better. And you go like, oh, I probably should have just committed more or explored that thing more or whatever, as opposed to being like trying to move on and realize like, oh, we didn't have anything. And I think
but it's also fresh, you know, this is something that I was speaking about the other day is that like you when you want to do that, right, you want to commit more and you want to you want to focus on an idea more and like really process it.
Mm-hmm.
If your scene partner doesn't want to, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like in that scene last night, we're just talking about this set. Everyone needs to get in your time machine and see this so you can understand this podcast. Mm-hmm. But I had to like use a lot of energy to corral my team to be like, I want to focus on this one. And they went with me. You know, they're great. But if your scene partner wants to move on or play it different, the committed person is, you know, or not committed, that's the wrong word, but the person who's trying to process that is going to, you're going to seem like you're holding the scene back or something. Or it's just going to feel like that. You're like the one who's not trying to have fun.
No, yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean? I mean, that'd be better if we had an example to discuss. But yeah, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. And the last thing I did with Mary, we kind of spoke on that, where it is like, if you are being the committed person and the other person's not necessarily responding in a way that necessarily highlights the committed reaction, then you look like, whether you're overreacting or you look crazy when it's like, how am I the crazy?
Yeah.
You know, so it's the thing of being like, knowing, having, then also knowing that within yourself to be like, okay, I'm feeling a little, okay, so I better than, okay, I know I'm coming off a little bit strong or whatever, like knowing when to like also then call yourself out because it's like, this is the only way this is going to continue.
Yeah, you got to be like, at some point you just got to be like, all right, let's watch Top Gun. You know, just put in Top Gun. It's fine, like whatever. Like you know, like yeah, like just you have to like loose it up at some point, unless you're both having that. But that's why sometimes you get some of those really cool scenes that are like just intellectual conversation improv,
mm-hmm.
where you just see like two people sitting down, just speaking about a topic and calling out all the brainstorming on like what's funny about it.
Yeah.
You know?
We're gearing up around the wind down time of this. So I guess and
let's wrap it up.
Yeah, let's wrap it up. But
we got stuff to do. Shit to do. We can curse here.
Yeah, we can. But
is shit still a curse?
I think so.
I was like wondering, is that like?
I mean, I think it's still. I mean, it's like on basic cable. I think they can say it. I think they say it more leisurely than it was. Like, oh, they said shit. Now it's like, oh yeah, somebody. People
shit
just say
lost
shit all the time.
Its edge, man.
Yeah, well, it did. As far as your improv goes right now, like, is there anything that you feel like? What are you working on or trying to expand, or as even like a teacher? What are you trying to like implement or teach more and things like that?
Yeah, the big concept that I've been focused on lately, although I have a few I bounce around, but the main thing is actually I've been focusing on making a big second move in your improv scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like once you get past, okay, I know what's unusual in this scene. We've done a great job of justifying it. Like I'm coaching a bunch of people who are like getting to the point where they're great at mining that unusual idea and then justifying it. And then it's like, okay, now what's next?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's happening? What is this scene? Or like, what is the first game move of it? And I think a lot of times that after you have your premise, making the first big move after that is scary because you're making yourself vulnerable
because
now you've decided the pattern of this scene or you've decided what the event of the scene is.
Mm-hmm.
And if the scene tanks, it's like almost your fault. You've ruined this good premise we have. But you should do it. Like, make those choices, and then feel them. It's okay if it's bad. Then you learn something from it. Because I watched too many scenes where it's like we've locked it in, and now we just get a drink, and then that's it. Or we watch Top Gun, or we just like watch something. You know, the amount of times I see scenes, just like, oh, let's just watch a TV or something. It's like, no, what's the scene? Like, are you make a big choice here?
Mm-hmm.
Be like, are you a speechwriter for Obama or something? Like, and you have to write the speech for tomorrow? Like, what is it? How can we apply this game to the scene that I'm watching now? Or play your game. Sometimes if these people don't play their game, you know, we just kind of get into that mode where like, oh, we like the premise. We get into a premise loop.
Oh,
where we just explain the premise over and over and over and over. So I've been doing this thing where I coach and I'll just be like, after this moment, they get the premise. I'll call out the improviser's name and be like, hey, Jeff. They're always Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's some like white hetero guy,
yeah,
Jeff.
Dude, all Jeffs.
Yeah, Jeffs, some Jordans. Jeffs. Yeah. and I go and I'll just be like, make a big choice right now. Right now, like in your scene. Make a big choice that you think is gonna ruin this scene. You know?
Uh-huh.
And you'd be surprised how many times they make the scene awesome. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think it's very interesting.
It's not a, yeah, and then, I think you need to, sometimes you got to like just jumpstart your scene after the premise is laid down.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense.
As opposed to just being like, you're unusual this way, you're unusual. Oh, well, hey, you know, you're unusual. And, you know, you're like, here's what the scene's about. And you go, like, yeah, but the scene is about this. And you're like, well, here's what I'm about. You know, you're getting that thing where it's like a rhythm. And it's like scene. Because improv is a weird way to do comedy. So you have like a comedic premise, then you have to play it out on the spot scenically. It's an acting based piece of comedy and it's scenic based. We should pay our scene a little more. That's something I like to, that's something like, you know, that I approach. It's like that. And then the other concept is being like deliberate. But I already gave you one, so I won't give you two because you already asked for it.
No, I mean,
we'll save that for the next.
Okay, all right. So, so in closing, because Mary asked me this because Mike still asked her, I guess. So then I want to ask
gonna
you.
Is going to be passed along?
Yeah, I guess so. If people are listening, it's going to be passed along.
I interview the next person, right? So I guess I'll have to keep this trend going.
I mean, you don't have to, but
I better
mean,
like this. I mean, better like this. Yeah, this better
it,
be good.
The question is, what is a piece of life advice you would give to like a young improviser coming up?
Oh, like, my piece of life advice is to have a life. I bet that's been said before.
I don't know what Mary
just
said.
Make sure you have a life. You can't eat, breathe, you know, and hold on my phone. You can't like eat, breathe, live, sleep, whatever that expression is, conquer, repeat, you can't do that. This is a wrestling reference. You can't just do improv. Like, you need to live your life. And have a life. And I think That's a piece of advice Gabrus gave me a long time ago. Uh-huh. He said this, like, you can't do improv, like, every single night of the week. Because you need to have a life to pull from. Uh-huh. You know, I mean, when I first started doing improv, I was 22. I just graduated college, and I thought I started way too late.
No. Uh-huh.
You know? And because there was guys I was improvising with who were, like, 17.
Oh, uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And they didn't even go – they didn't go to college. They just went right – your UCB was their college experience. And looking back, I feel like – I feel bad for them. Uh-huh. The college experience was like – that was so priceless to me, that time in my life of, like – and I pull so much from it, from that experience and people I met at that point in my life that – it's what you say. I'm specific. Mm-hmm. I'm specific to my experience in my life. So if your whole existence is going to be UCB, is going to be just hanging around this theater, which is the great, it should be, it can be a big part of your life, but it can't be the only part of your life. Like, you need to explore, you need to watch professional wrestling with me. Mm. You need, you know, I think you just need to make sure that, like, you're living your life and experiencing it in other ways, because you'll be, like, shocked how much it inspires you.
Mm-hmm.
That's something, that's advice that I got that I didn't even really take that well. You know, I mean, I think, like, when I was that age, I was just like a theater rat. But for me, I was experiencing theater for the first time.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't... Not 100% the first time, but really the first time where I was truly engulfed in art, as corny as it sounds, because I went to business school, you know, and I was and I think business school, but I had that background, you know, like I had that. So yeah, I really think you should explore other things outside of just, and that goes, I think, for like acting and anything that's serving your improv. I think you need things that are truly separate. Maybe love.
Mm-hmm.
Try love. Don't deny love for improv. Mm-hmm. That would be,
that makes sense.
That would be a true tragedy. Maybe the saddest thing of all time.
And that's the kind of thing that we're talking about, when it is like, even if that answer has kind of been given, but then you then pontificate on that and specifically to your experience, which then even this is kind of like the same framework of an answer, but like the meat inside of it is different. And yeah. I think that's the same thing you're talking about when you do improv. It's like, you can do that same thing, but if you're doing it through, if you can do that same kind of premise, if you're doing it though specifically to your voice and your experience, then it's going to be a different scene. It's going to be a scene that you haven't seen before.
Right.
You know? So that's the, so I'm just saying definitely, that as far as your answer.
Yeah. Hopefully that does it. That's the kind of note, it is hard to get through to people's brains who are like, I totally relate. I was very like head down, like, you know, I like ended friendships. I was like the guy from Whiplash, you know, doing improv. Just being like, I can't go to your birthday. I got a show in like some basement for three people, you know?
It's like the guy.
And now I'm one of the greats.
Yeah. and there you have it, folks. And that was a long form conversation. Tune in next episode when Dan Black will be your host. I'm supposed to say thank you, so I guess I want to thank people. Thank you, UCB, for letting us do this. Like Mike still, I guess. Thank you, Marla Black, for letting me in. thank you, Alexis, for sitting there making sure these levels are great. And thank you, Dan, for sitting down and just
check me out on Twitter at the Black Attack. I got an Instagram at Dan Black Attack. You can see pictures of my dog.
All right. And that's it. Thank you, everyone. Bye. Yeah.
You've been listening to the UCB Long Form Conversations podcast on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and review at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. The opinions expressed in this episode are those of the comedians talking and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of UCB Theater or Training Center. Find cutting edge comedy videos on YouTube and Vimeo at UCB Comedy. Find our live shows at UCBtheater.com and connect with us on social media at UCB Comedy. This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.